Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to University of New England's Innovation Hall in Portland for an evening for the environment to benefit Maine Conservation Voters and Maine Conservation Alliance. The title of today's talk is Celebrating the Year's Conservation Victories. You'll hear from Governor Janet Mills celebrating the policy victories of 2019 and Richard Louv, author of the national best-selling book Last Child in the Woods. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing the program today is Maureen Druin, Executive Director of Maine Conservation Voters and Maine Conservation Alliance.
Good evening, everyone. I am Maureen Druin, Executive Director of Maine Conservation Voters and Maine Conservation Alliance. And I welcome you to the Evening for the Environment. I am so delighted that Governor Janet Mills and author Richard Louv are here tonight. And I welcome Curtis Picard, whose organization is receiving the Harrison Richardson Award. I'd also like to recognize House Speaker Sarah Gideon. Commissioner Judy Camuso. Commissioner Amanda Beal. Senator Ned Claxton. And Representatives Teresa Peirce, Dean Rikerson, Janice Cooper, and Patrick Corey. Thank you all so much for your incredible leadership. Tonight wouldn't be possible without the generous support of our host committee and our business, foundation, and organizational sponsors, especially Hannah Quimby and the Quimby Family Foundation. Bangor Savings Bank, Lee Auto Malls, Diversified Communications, Elliottsville Plantation, and the Island Institute. Thank you all so much. And a very special thank you to Rainey Schaefer, who runs this committee and which is ably chaired by Adam Lee. Thank you, Adam. I'd like to take a moment to respectfully acknowledge that we are on the traditional land of the Wabanaki people and extend our gratitude to the many indigenous people and their ancestors who have stewarded this land throughout the generations. The Evening for the Environment is about celebration. Celebration of our connection to nature. Celebration of the year's environmental successes. And celebration of the people who never stop fighting for the earth, no matter how hard it gets. Now, how many of you were here at the Evening for the Environment last year when EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy spoke? So several of you. She was amazing, right? What a firecracker. We were at the end of the LePage administration, halfway through the first term of the Trump administration, and Gina, who was seeing so much of her legacy at the EPA being overturned, said, "If I can get out of bed every morning and be hopeful, then you can get out there and be hopeful too." She shared her belief that reducing carbon pollution, fighting climate change, and protecting people's health represented the core values of the United States of America. She said, "Nothing good ever comes easy," and ended her speech by telling us to get out and go vote. We didn't know it then, but we were on the cusp of a transformative election in Maine. We would witness a powerful climate justice movement led by our children, and we would see our governor declare to the General Assembly of the United Nations that Maine would be carbon neutral by the year 2045. As Governor Mills said at her inauguration, streams, like the people of Maine, will change direction on occasion to find the best way forward. Sometimes success is measured by defending the progress you have already made. And sometimes you are lucky enough to have a governor who says to the world, "What is more precious than water, air, soil, the health and happiness of our children?" Within the first few minutes of taking the oath of office, Governor Mills, the first governor from Franklin County, said, "Tonight I say enough. Enough with studies. Enough with talk and debate. It is time to act." This past year, together with the leadership of Speaker Gideon, Senate President Jackson, and legislators from both political parties, Governor Mills made action on climate change a priority. Because of her leadership, Maine will reduce our carbon pollution by 80% and transition to 100% renewable energy by the year 2050. Governor Mills told the United Nations in September that Maine won't wait, that we must unite to preserve our precious common ground for our common planet in uncommon ways for this imperative common purpose. Certainly, her Climate Council will do just that, using the creativity and ingenuity of Maine people to solve the problems and enact the solutions that this state needs. It hasn't even been a year yet, but if her first 10 months in office are any indication, Governor Mills' legacy will be defined by action on one of the greatest challenges of our time. On behalf of Maine Conservation Alliance and Maine Conservation voters, and indeed on behalf of future generations, Governor Mills, we say thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, what a difference a year can make. I've been lucky. I'm the luckiest person in the world to be governor of my home state, a state I love so much, and to be supported by people like yourselves, by the conservation voters who were such a force in last November's elections. No question about it. You spoke and spoke loudly. And I appreciate that, and the people of Maine appreciate everything you do. Let me take you back to the year 1970. This won't take that long, but a little girl named Suzanne Clooney, who lived on the banks of what was then a reeking Androscoggin River, choked by a steady sludge of pollution, wrote to her United States senator. The little deer, the animals Suzanne remembered drinking from the river, were long gone, as were the chokeberry blossoms that, quote, filled the air with the sweetest smell on earth. Fed up with what was happening to her own environment, Suzanne wrote, quote, "I'm sick of the river like this. Please do something about it." She signed her letter to Senator Edmund S. Muskie as, quote, "one who loves Maine." I remember the Androscoggin River and the Kennebec and the Penobscot River, and the Androscoggin flowing through my home territory was this thick with sulfur sludge. You could almost walk across it in the 60s and the 70s. Suzanne's letter was one of just many that inspired Senator Muskie's career-long fight to protect clean air and clean water, marking a significant step in Maine's movement towards a green future. And tonight we celebrate the contributions to that movement. Continuing today, in January, we toasted to our state's future and celebrated hard-won election night victories of environmental champions up and down the ballot of every party. The people of Maine sent a clear message. It was time for a new and better direction, especially in charting the path to a clean environment and a clean energy future. From the Blaine House to the State Senate and the State House of Representatives, we began the legislative session with more elected public officials, Republicans and Democrats, Greens and Independents, who were devoted to preserving Maine's environment. And with their help, we enacted major bipartisan renewable energy and climate change legislation in what some have called one of the most productive sessions for climate change of any state in the country. We are, as Maureen pointed out, dedicated, committed to achieving 80% renewable energy by 2030, and from 40% today, and 100% by 2050, one of the most ambitious renewable standards in the country. We set a goal of installing 100,000 heat pumps in Maine by 2025 to reduce Maine's dependency on fossil fuel and to reduce energy costs for consumers. We invested in clean energy and conservation, electric vehicles, energy efficiency, and community resiliency, and we're advocating for sequestration of carbon in our soil and our forests through our continuing sustainable forestry practices and progressive agricultural practices. Thank you, Amanda Beal. Thank you, Judy Camuso. Thank you to the best cabinet a governor ever had in the state of Maine. And we banned single-use plastic carryout bags and styrofoam foam and beverage containers. And I'm so pleased to be here with Curtis and the folks from his board for him to receive this award tonight. With overwhelming bipartisan support in the legislature, we created the Maine Climate Council, made up of businesses and scientists, tribal and youth representatives, academics, lawmakers, and policymakers from all levels. Great Maine minds working together to figure out how to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and cut our appetite for fossil fuels, on which we've come to depend so, so much, for heat, electricity, and transportation. These efforts, I'm fully persuaded, will not impair or hurt our economy. They will, in fact, improve it. We know that investing in clean energy creates good-paying green-collar jobs. From technicians installing solar panels to contractors weatherizing homes, engineers running wind farms, Maine's elected officials from every political party, as well as industry leaders, auto dealers, business owners, youth and environmentalists, including Maine conservation voters, have championed these changes, united in their shared love for our great state. This is how it should be. You know, protecting Maine's precious natural resources is not some partisan rallying cry. It's not a new thing to the Democratic Party, or the Republican Party, or the Green Party. It is a responsibility and challenge for our entire state and everybody in it. This past legislative session, we returned at last to the movement for a clean energy future that Republicans and Democrats both have led together for many generations in Maine. Republicans like Harry Richardson, who worked to establish the Land Use Regulation Commission to protect lands and waters from pollution and from haphazard development. Sherry Huber, who revitalized the Maine Audubon Society and championed Maine's forest at the Maine Tree Foundation. These lawmakers, past and present, believed in climate change, known then as global warming. And as Sherry Huber said more than 10 years ago, quote, "The issues we face are neither Republican nor Democratic. They are issues that affect all of us and the future of our country. We need to think about the world we're leaving to our children." America, she said, should lead again the fight on issues that cross borders but impact everyday people at home, like global warming. And then Maine Democrats like Ted Kaufman and Linda McKee, who spearheaded conservation initiatives and protected endangered wildlife, including loon and moose and bears. Outside the legislature, Maine statesmen in the national scene were also championing change on the national stage. Senator Bill Cohen was the only Republican member of the United States Senate who was endorsed by the League of Conservation Voters time after time for his longstanding commitment to the environment. Maine Senator Edmund S. Muskie spent years shaping the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts and securing their passage. He remarked on his efforts and called upon his colleagues to work across party lines in defense of our planet when he said back in 1974, quote, "Brotherhood is both a form of freedom and a promise of sacrifice. As we learn that our planet is a fragile physical support, we learn as well that cooperation is what holds it and us together." And then later, Maine's U.S. Senator George Mitchell, as you know, led the charge in advancing the Clean Air Amendments in the early 80s. My administration is simply working to honor that special promise that those senators made and those predecessors made years ago. We're going to do that in Augusta and around the world. We have joined the bipartisan U.S. Climate Alliance, a coalition of 24 states and Puerto Rico, determined to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and combating climate change, regardless of what happens in Washington. Because while we're only states in one territory, we represent 55% of the United States population. And we represent $11.7 trillion of the national economy. I think we have a little bit of power in our hands, a little economic force, and we're using it. A few weeks ago, as Maureen said, I stood in front of the United Nations General Assembly and announced that Maine will be carbon neutral by 2045. And I implored leaders from 193 countries around the world to do their part to combat climate change and move our world towards a clean energy, green future. And 2 weeks ago, I led the largest delegation ever from the state of Maine to the Arctic Circle Assembly, an annual international gathering on the Arctic, which drew 2,500 participants from 60 countries. Speaking before that assembly, I renewed our state's commitment to other lands, other cities, other people, whose love of the ocean we share, of the air we breathe, of the climate we're prepared to defend, is unparalleled. Maine people, you know, especially young people, have always led the way in the pursuit of clean air, water, and earth. And it's the youth whose passion now propels this movement. A young girl named Caitlin from Elliott, Maine, about the same age as Suzanne Clooney was when she wrote her letter to Senator Muskie in 1970, wrote me recently and implored me to help address climate change. She assured me that she, too, is helping as best she can. She said, "I am writing to you about global warming. Quote, almost everyone in the world is making it happen. I'm trying to help as best I can. I'm wondering if you can help," she said. "Even though I'm 10, I'm not going to sit around and wait for people to do it for me because 10 bucks says they're not going to." Thank you, Caitlin. Well, Caitlin, you can keep your 10 bucks because we're not waiting either. Tonight, as we celebrate the many accomplishments of this legislative session and our restored partnerships in Maine and abroad, let us recommit to finishing the movement Maine people led and started so long ago and pursue a clean, green future for our great state. I want to thank you for all your hard work and commend Curtis and his association for their work. On behalf of the people of Maine and the climate in Maine and our administration, as you know, you will always find an open door, an open mind, and an open heart. Thank you.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. You just heard from Governor Janet Mills discussing the environmental policy victories of 2019. And introducing keynote speaker Richard Louv is Hannah Quimby, director of the Quimby Family Foundation.
I am honored to introduce Richard Louv this evening, as his work has impacted me on a professional and personal level for years. Richard's 2005 book, Last Child in the Woods, inspired an international movement and gave voice to a disturbing trend which many of us were observing. Children were increasingly disconnected from nature. In 2006, Richard co-founded the Children and Nature Network to support the people and organizations working to reconnect children with nature, and their research library was invaluable as I wrote my graduate thesis on the healing power of time spent outdoors. The mission of our family foundation has also been greatly influenced by his writing. My passion for this issue was ignited by Richard's writing and also stems from my own experience of a childhood spent deep in the woods of Maine with no electricity or running water and with very limited adult supervision. Or as my mom likes to say, we were raised with benign neglect. So, in these past few days, I have to keep reminding myself that my admiration for Richard Louvre is far greater than my fear of public speaking. I'm going to start by reading an excerpt from Drew Dillinger's poem called Hieroglyphic Stairway. I read it this past May on my first Mother's Day while holding my newborn baby boy, and and it's been in my head ever since. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do when the planet was plundering? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing. As the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? Now I'll share a few highlights from Richard's biography, and then I'll focus on why he's addressing us at Evening for the Environment and how his work is deeply meaningful here in Maine. Richard Louvre is a journalist and author of 9 books, which have been translated and published in 24 countries. In 2008, he was awarded the Audubon Medal, presented by the National Audubon Society. Among other awards, Louvre is the recipient of the Cox Award for 2007, Clemson University's highest honor for sustained achievement in public service. Louvre has written for the New York Times, the Times of London, Parents Magazine, and many other publications, and has appeared on CBS This Morning, NBC's Today Show, ABC's Good Morning America, NPR's Talk of the Nation, and Maine Calling with Jennifer Rooks. His 10th book, Our Wild Calling, Exploring the Evolving Relationship Between Humans and Other Animals, is available from booksellers in early November. We are the first group of people the book is available to, and you will also have the opportunity to get an autographed copy later this evening. So here we are at Evening for the Environment to celebrate monumental policy victories of 2019 and get inspired to continue protecting the Maine we all love. Maybe it's obvious to you, but maybe you're wondering how an international movement to connect children to nature relates to human and environmental health. And is it even relevant in Maine? Despite our beautiful rural areas, urban green space, and trails, we are experiencing the same challenges here in Maine as other states across the nation. Children now spend an average of just 12 minutes a day playing outside, and more than 10 hours inside being inactive. More than 65,000 Maine children ages 2 to 17 have been diagnosed with a developmental, mental or behavioral issue, including autism, depression or anxiety, post-traumatic stress, and attention deficit disorder. Research shows that time outdoors is the forgotten healer, which can improve our physical, emotional, and spiritual health, as well as the health of this planet. Time outdoors improves our health while also supporting an environmental ethic. Studies show what many of us have intuitively known to be true. Direct nature experiences in childhood are associated with pro-environmental preferences in adulthood. And one day, our children will be voters. Persuasive environmental advocacy is often deeply rooted in positive time outdoors as a young person. At a time when an understandably furious 16-year-old is pleading with world leaders to take action, when there is mounting evidence that if we don't act swiftly and with great urgency, the next generation of people and the species we share this planet with will suffer immensely, we must all strive to answer to future generations, what did you do once you knew? In his book, Last Child in the Woods, Richard Louv wrote in a beautiful and heartbreaking way when describing what childhood used to look like and the impact on young people who are now primarily growing up indoors, even here in Maine. But what I appreciate most about Louv's writing is that in this time when hope wavers, given the crisis we face, he isn't all gloom and doom. He is crystal clear about the issue and then inspires the reader and equips us with ideas and advice for creating a nature-rich life. He believes in the power of nature to help individuals and communities heal. Time outdoors for all people is a basic human need and a basic human right. I feel very fortunate to be engaged in this movement alongside Richard Louv on the board of the Children in Nature Network and with many of you in the audience tonight. I'm hopeful because I have the privilege of working with Maine's nonprofit leaders who run wildlife centers, summer camps, nature-based preschools, environmental learning centers, and who are working together in collaboration and through networks to ensure that all young people have safe and accessible outdoor experiences. You care deeply about the next generation and providing opportunities for our children to fall in love with this planet in peril, which they will inherit. I will now finally, for someone who doesn't like public speaking, turn it over to our keynote speaker for the evening. Richard, we are thrilled and honored that you are here tonight to address this audience of caretakers and change makers. Please join me in welcoming Richard Louv.
Listening to both Hannah and Governor Mills, I would say if anyone in America is feeling despair right now, they should come to Maine. And I really mean that. I visit a lot of states, and I've been to Maine twice, and I always feel hopeful when I come here. I'm not quite sure why. And listening to you, Governor, and listening to Hannah told me why. Hannah, you did such a good job of describing the issue of the disconnect between children and nature, which means, of course, the disconnect eventually of adults from nature. About 14 years ago when this book came out, I was stunned that there was so little research when I was researching the book on the impact of the natural world on child development, in fact, on human development. Why wasn't something so large being studied more? At the time, I was working with some neuroscientists who were among the most important experts in the country on the architecture of children's brains in the early years and the development of that brain architecture. And they were studying all kinds of things and how the parent-child attachment, how childcare, how violence in neighborhoods, about all kinds of things, how they affected the brain architecture development of young children. And I asked them one day, because I was working on this book, I said, have you ever thought about how the natural world experiences in that affect child brain development in young children? And they looked at me with a blank face and said, what's nature? I mean, literally, somebody said that of these neuroscientists. And I was puzzled by that, and I finally said to the neuroscientist, this isn't brain surgery. come up with a definition, 120 trees per acre, I don't know, and then a hypothesis, and then test it. The irony was that they were already doing this. Yes, they were using animal subjects, some of them. And over here, very stressed out group of pigeons. Over here, a cool group of pigeons, because they were in what the scientists considered a more natural habitat inside the lab. The minute you asked those scientists to step outside the lab, they were lost. They didn't know what to do. There's two reasons for the lack of research at that point, I think. One is this kind of blind spot in science, and it's understandable. Nature is very difficult to describe. In the current book I've been working on now for 4 years, I learned that there's about 124 definitions of life in science. We can't even decide what's alive. So it's understandable that that would be there, but, you know, come up with a hypothesis and test it. The other reason is, where does the research money come from? What pill can you sell? Now, there were about 60 studies that I could find to cite in Last Child in the Woods. Today, if you go to the Children Nature Network website, to the research library, we have independent, very independent, summaries of that research done on our website. So one place in the world you can go and see the majority of the research, and it's still being added to. It's gone from about 60 to almost 1,000 studies today. It's now a growth industry, what was once ignored. They're still coming in at about 15 to 20 studies a month from somewhere in the world. And basically, they all point in the same direction, that this is fundamental to child development, fundamental to human development throughout our lives, no matter how old we are. Now, why should something that fundamental? I've already asked the question about research, but truly, why is this not considered a human right? If it's that fundamental, if E.O. Wilson is correct in his biophilia hypothesis, that we are hardwired to have an affiliation with the rest of nature, and when we don't get enough of that, we don't do so well. If he's right about that, this is ingrained in us, this is part of our humanity, then anything that is that fundamental to our humanity should be considered a human right. And any child, no matter what kind of economic background, no matter what race or ethnicity, what kind of neighborhood, whether it's rural or urban, every child, no matter what their abilities or disabilities, every child has a right to that experience in nature. I wrote a piece, Sierra Magazine a few months ago asked me to write a piece, and they made it a cover story trying to illustrate that question, try to answer that question if you're interested in reading more about that. This should be something that we would just assume, but it's not. We should just assume, and many of us did when we were growing up, that this was good for kids, but we did not. This question virtually wasn't asked 30 years ago. So it's strange, because now we don't have a base, you know, base studies to compare 30 years later, because nobody asked the question. But we do see progress. One of those is in the research. Hannah mentioned many of them. The number of nature-based preschools has mushroomed. It's increased by about 500%. Now, that's not saying much, because it started at such a low number, but now it's in the hundreds, and it used, you know, just a few years ago, it was about 8 in the whole country. Europe is ahead of us on this. More and more teachers are taking this seriously. I said today on the radio show in Maine that, here in Maine, that in the beginning, teachers were kind of the worst audience. Here's this guy, he's asking us to do one more thing. We're overwhelmed. Today, they're among the best audiences, and I think there's two reasons. One is that they're tired to death along the way of Leave No Child Behind, of recess being canceled. School district after school district across the country canceled recess. There's lots of research that shows that recess and physical education and language and art improves science scores, improves math scores. Lots of evidence, but school boards ignored it. enthralled with technology. But that's changing now, slowly in public schools, but more quickly in independent schools. Other things have changed. In 2010, I was asked to give the keynote to the American Academy of Pediatrics, their national conference. There's about 5,000 pediatricians and pediatric nurse practitioners and others in the audience. First, I was stunned to be asked. I mean, nature deficit disorder, really? You're asking me to talk about that? And I make really clear in everything I write about that this is not a known medical diagnosis. Maybe it should be, but it's not yet. It is, though, a way to talk about this thing we've all sensed was happening for a long time. The response, to my surprise, was great. Many of those pediatricians went home and started prescribing, literally writing prescriptions for nature. One of them, Dr. Robert Czar in D.C., you might have read about him. He not only started writing prescriptions for nature, he organized his fellow pediatricians in Washington, D.C., and they created a database of all the open space, all the parks, so they could sit there and not only write the prescription, but turn to the computer and say to the family, there's a park a block and a half from your house, and here's what you can do there. That is changing. Mainstream medicine, at least in pediatrics, is taking this seriously now. Eco-psychology has grown in great bounds. It was already growing then, but it's grown much quicker since then. Cities are now taking this seriously. The Children Nature Network is working with the National League of Cities. National League of Cities represents about 18,000 mayors and other city officials. I've lost track of the number of cities, Hannah, maybe you remember, but we're now working with, I think, 19 or 20 pilot cities. Don't know if any are in Maine. I should have looked that up. And the idea is first to ask, what does it mean to be a nature-rich city? What does that look like? What does a city need to do in order to connect families to nature in the city? Not sending them to Yosemite, but in the city. What does that look like? The second is, how do you track that over time, the success of what you've done? And the third mission is, how do you train future mayors to create nature-rich cities? I'm convinced that cities can become engines of biodiversity. We can begin in our own backyards. There's a fellow who's written a book called Bringing Nature Home, whose name I'm blanking on right now. I'll think of it in a minute. Doug Ptolemy, thank you, who is a hero of mine, and I promote him and his idea more than he does. He's shy. Basically, he says, we can create a homegrown national park. We can do it by starting in our yards. He's done the math. He says, if we really want to do something about climate change, we'll probably send a little less money to the Amazon rainforest effort and change our yards to plant more native species, which brings back the food chain, brings back first the insects and all of the animals that come with it that have been created by evolution to nurture that particular bioregion. My wife and I did that, or she did it more than I did, and the great news is that I don't have to mow the lawn anymore. And I look out at it, and we've since moved to the mountains near San Diego, but while I was there, I could look out on our backyard, and it was beautiful. I didn't have to mow anymore, and it was beautiful, and we started seeing butterflies that we'd never seen before. We started seeing lizards we'd never seen before. In fact, those lizards out in the backyard, I'd look out from my computer and see them doing their push-ups. And, you know, there was more posturing in my backyard than in the U.S. Congress. And they make me laugh, like they made you laugh. And that's part of my social capital. Why is it when we talk about social capital, we only talk about one species? Now, those lizards didn't, or maybe they did. The lizards didn't know they were part of my social capital, but they were. We need to start talking about human nature's social capital, not just the social capital of one species. What if it wasn't just our yard? What if it's the next yard, the next one over, skip a couple yards, and that one? Pretty soon, if you did that enough, you'd have wildlife corridors on private land lacing through a city and then beyond that city, and pretty soon have a homegrown national park. when I suggested that to Sally Jewell, who's been really supportive of our movement, who I understand spoke here, the Secretary of Interior under Obama, she was kind of horrified by that idea, as was Fran Minella, the former head of the National Park Service, who's on our board. They said, well, you don't understand. The National Park Service kind of owns national park as a phrase. I said, how can that be? How many nations have national parks? And so I said, okay, never mind. We'll just skip that problem. Let's call it a worldwide homegrown park. Why stop there? Why not have kids in Sri Lanka on the internet trading notes with kids in Portland about what's happened to their neighborhood when they transformed it through native plants and through creating wildlife habitats? I want to talk real quickly, too, about the new book, which is a rough segue to what I was going to talk about. When you look at the research on the impact of the natural world on human development, on child development, I was struck, as I think you would be, by how much of it is about green space, as it should be. You see, wild animals mentioned very infrequently. There's actually very little study about the impact of wild animals on human beings, on, you know, other than the mountain lion that occasionally attacks. You won't see studies about their benefit to us very much. You do see a lot of research now on animal-assisted therapy, which is growing very quickly. And it's not just the person that gets on the airplane with the ostrich. It's a growing effort to use animals in therapy. It's mainly horses and dogs. By the way, I learned in the research of this book that horses actually have more facial expressions than dogs. And it's one of the reasons they're so effective, equine therapy is so effective. In any case, we know about that, but we don't know about these wild animals and how they affect us. This book has a lot of stories. Some involve children, a lot of them involve adults. I'll just tell a couple of them. And it's about domestic animals as well as wild animals, the book. One of them is about a pet. Most of us experience this with pets, but we may not have the words to describe it. A woman in Toronto, a mother, told me how she had a young son and a dog named Jack, and the Jack was a big dog. She walks into the living room one day, and her son is stretched out on the carpet with Jack stretched out next to him. And her six-year-old son has his arm around Jack. And she hears her son say, "Mommy, I don't have a heart anymore." And she says, "What are you saying?" And he said, "My heart is in Jack." That permeability, we remember that when we were kids. That permeability between creatures. We feel that between us and other human beings. I think we also feel it with other animals. And we forget that as we grow older, many of us. Another story, this is Paul Dayton, who is an oceanographer at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Now, he is a hardcore scientist. He's one of the most famous oceanographers among oceanography. And he told me how one day he was at the bottom of the ocean and he was poking around collecting samples, and he felt something really large come right above him and stop. That's usually not a good sign. And he slowly looked up, and as he looked up, he saw a tentacle coming down, and then another one coming down. And then he looked up and saw a giant octopus, the kind that has 12 feet wingspan. And he said something that scientists won't like him to have said, which was, "The octopus decided I was a clam, And it came down and it got me. Okay? Wrapped him up in its arms. Now, the arms of octopuses are really interesting, or octopi, are really interesting. They are where the brains of octopuses are distributed throughout the body, including in the arms. And the arms have photons in them. So in a sense, this octopus was sensing him, getting to know him with its arms, and even in a sense seeing him with its arms. And he said, people think those tentacles are soft. They're not. They're really hard. You cannot move them. Right about then, he realized he was running out of air. And with his last strength, he kicked off the bottom. And he and the octopus, the giant octopus, started going up through the column of water. And as they went up, and I love telling this story because I love seeing people in the audience squirm, as they're going up, the octopus is moving around Paul's body. He can feel the razor shark beak moving around his neck. And then he's looking into the octopus's eye. And as they approach the surface, Paul, and remember, he's a hardcore scientist, he'd get kicked out of some conferences for saying this, he said he and the octopus made a non-aggression pact. And then they hit the surface of the water. And Paul ripped off his mask. The octopus is right below the surface. He's looking at it. It's looking at him. They have eye contact. Rips off his mask. And what does Paul do? First, the octopus changes into what he said was the shape of a space shuttle. And then it heads down fast into the darkness. And what does Paul do after he rips off his mask? He chases it down. He couldn't help it. He chased the octopus into the darkness until he could no longer see it. Why did you do that, Paul? And he has no idea except that it was, the hardcore scientist says, a spiritual experience. And then he came back up. Now, anthropomorphism is a dirty word, or has been in science, but some of the scientists are beginning to change how they view that. There's something called critical anthropomorphism now that I think should be taught in schools, that could be employed by many conservation groups too in their youth programs, etc. Critical anthropomorphism, for some reason herpetologists really like this a lot, and critical anthropomorphism, and the guy Bergdorf, I think, is the scientist who came up with this, basically says, in his words, if you're going to study a snake, you need to wear the shoes of the snake. A pretty funny phrase. By that, he means if you're going to study a snake, you have to sit with a snake. You have to get to know the snake. And so he says this is two steps. The first thing you do is, as you're with that snake, you apply in your mind all of the hard science you know about how that snake senses the world. What is it doing with its tongue? He says, but the second step is to use your imagination to become the snake. What's interesting about this is he says that if you do that, the chances that you will ask the right scientific questions is greatly improved. This is not anti-science. This is not dressing up poodles in hats and dresses. This is empathy. This is feeling empathy for the natural world, for other beings. I was on in my boat one day on a lake near where we lived in San Diego, and I was out there alone. I have a little electric motor. And I saw what I thought were two vultures on the shore eating a dead carp. So I eased up closely to the vultures and got within about 20 feet and realized they were not vultures. They were two giant golden eagles. It's unusual to get that close to golden eagles. One of them flew up, went around a peak, and then came back down. They continued to eat. And for what seemed like a long time, one of the things I've learned is that there are certain altered states that happen when we have these encounters with wild animals. One of them is that time either goes away or feels like it's bending. So for a long time, may have been a short time, I went back and forth and looked at those eagles. And they would do this. They would lean down, take a bite of the carp, and then look up at me. And then they would lean down and look up at me. We maintained that eye contact for a long time. Again, it seemed like a long time. Now, something happened. I don't know whether I don't know what they were thinking. Maybe they were just wondering if I was edible. But something happened. I felt it happen. And the stories I've collected, there's about 80 of these stories, I think, in the book that other people have told me. Sometimes hardcore scientists, sometimes kids, sometimes healers, all kinds of people told me their stories. They almost always have these special characteristics, this sense of awe, and time slowing down, a sense of scale changing. I went home and told my younger son, Matthew. He was home for college. He's the son I knew had the fishing gene because when he was 3, I caught him fishing in the humidifier. He did pretty well. It's true. I said, Matthew, in so many words, whoever I say I am, I'm not. Whoever I was in those moments is who I actually am. And I don't have the words to describe that. This is beyond human language. This is pre-language. This is the oldest language that we still share with the other creatures that we share the world with. It's kind of a forgotten language. Martin Buber, and I always have to, the great intellectual, I always have to be careful not to say Justin Bieber. Martin Buber wrote a great essay called I and Thou, and he wrote it about human beings. And he said basically that you and I don't exist. What exists is right here. It's the relationship. And without that, we actually kind of don't exist. He said some people consider that a kind of, he said he considered it a kind of electricity that some people call God. He wrote about people and that relationship. I think we need to begin to apply that to the rest of nature. But we're closest to animals. We can apply it to plants as well. We now know a lot more about plant communication, and it's fascinating. We know a lot more about bird communication, for instance. We know a lot more about not only how animals communicate within their own species, but across species and with us. It's kind of a whisper that's all around us. Now, that may sound, Outside Magazine just did an article, it's in this month's issue, about the book and a little bit about me. And it says I sound kind of new agey. Now, I grew up in Kansas. And that's the first time I've been called new agey. But I'll plead guilty if that sounds a little too metaphysical for people. I think there's something there. I think there is something there between Paul and the octopus, between me and the eagles, and between the little boy and his dog, Jack. That permeability. I decided in the book that nobody that I could find has really named that thing between us and other animals. And again, it may just be a projection. It may not be from the other animal. I don't believe that, but it may not be. I don't think it necessarily matters. So in the book, I call that the habitat of the heart. There are two habitats. There's the habitat that is the physical habitat that you work so hard. Many of us work so hard to protect, as we should, and we see it slipping away. But then there's this other habitat, the habitat of the heart. If one of those habitats goes, so does the other. I think the future of environmentalism, in many ways, is equally about the habitat of the heart as it is about the physical habitat. We have to love our fellow creatures. There is good reason to do that. Medical folks, World Health Organization, others talk increasingly about the epidemic of loneliness in the world. Epidemic may be too strong a word, some say. But the rate of loneliness now is so troubling to many medical folks that they're saying it's about to surpass obesity as a cause of mortality among human beings. And it's not just because of suicide, because loneliness, social isolation is associated with all kinds of diseases. We are becoming more and more lonely as a species. So I think that part of that is what we've done to ourselves, and some of that is antisocial networking and all kinds of things. But I think it's rooted in an even deeper loneliness than human loneliness. I think it's rooted in species loneliness. We are desperate not to feel alone in the world. The urban parks with the highest degree of psychological benefit for human beings happen to be the parks with the highest biodiversity, the highest number of other species. We are desperate not to feel alone in the universe. This is part of the source of religion, of course. But the truth is, we're not alone. We're surrounded by a larger family. We are members of a larger family. There's a kind of, we are surrounded by intimacy. What if we were to teach that to kids? What if we were to talk about that in schools? What if we were to set up wildlife watch groups in our neighborhoods, not only to get to know the animals in our bioregion in our own neighborhood and protect them, but to also protect ourselves from zoonotic diseases and, you know, the mountain lion that comes through that looks too aggressive. We can do both. We can protect ourselves in cities from now the high number of wild animals that are coming into cities, but we can also protect them. And instead of exterminating them, have them enter our family and we enter theirs. What kind of world would that be? How much more interesting that would be for kids to learn about than the data of biology. I really would like to thank you for all that you're doing. There's people here who are doing amazing things. I learned about some of those today on the radio show from the two other people there on the show with me. And Maine is, as I learned from the governor and from you, Hannah, and many of others, is a kind of epicenter for the Children and Nature movement, for the People and Nature movement. Thank you for everything you do. It's sacred work.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speakers were Governor Janet Mills and author Richard Louv. They recently spoke at an evening for the environment to benefit Maine Conservation Voters and Maine Conservation Alliance. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.